Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Punch Radio. I am Leslie Pariseau, your host. I'm here with my co-host, Talia Bayoki, who is the editor-in-chief of Punch Magazine. We're a magazine all about drinking. And today...
Yum.
Today we're talking about eating in bars and drinking in restaurants. But first up, we're gonna do a quick little news bit, which has to do with eating and drinking. Namely, the case of one man who gets drunk off of carbs. This came up in the news this week. It's there's a man who has what's called autobrewery syndrome. It's a rare and somewhat controversial medical condition where yeast in your stomach actually turns carbohydrates from food into excess alcohol in the blood, resulting in being drunk off of pasta and bread and chips.
So, yeah, that's good news. Do not try at home. In other news, it was discovered that Two-Buck Chuck, as according to Hugh Atkinson, as he tweeted, is not only gross, but it's also slowly killing you. It was found that 24 winemakers were... a Denver laboratory found that 24 different winemakers had wines with high levels of arsenic. So this has been an ongoing thing. People are debating whether or not having a little bit of arsenic in your wine is really a problem. But I would say that poison is never something that you want to have with dinner.
Not eating arsenic today.
Not at all.
So we're going to jump into the show. So I mentioned it's about eating in bars and drinking in restaurants. And the reason that we're talking about this is because on punchdrink.com, we recently debuted a new column, which our contributing editor, Regan Hoffman, who is here with us today, has brought into being. It's called Eating in Bars.
Hi, guys.
Also joining us is Kat Kinsman, the editor-in-chief of Tasting Table.
Hey there.
So everyone in the room has a pretty good idea of what it means to eat in bars and drink in bars and drink in restaurants and eat in restaurants. So we just wanted to start today and introduce, one, the column, and two, talk about what bar food is. So I'm going to pass this off to Regan.
What is bar food? It seems like a pretty existential question today.
It is, especially today, which is kind of why we...
Physically right now. At this very moment.
Exactly.
We're about to get a pizza with our beer, so yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, we are all in a restaurant right now. Many people are drinking here. The idea for this column really came about as we were talking. You know, I've been a food writer for a long time. I've been a drinks writer now. I'm started working with Punch in his editorial capacity. And it's just like the two worlds kind of keep coming together. And over the past, 5 years, they've been coming together more and more and more. And you get all these bars now that are opening that have full menus and they have full kitchens. And they're, for all intents and purposes, a restaurant, but they call themselves bars. And at the same time, you've got all these restaurants that are really putting a lot of time and energy into developing serious bar programs and bringing in really skilled bartenders to develop, house cocktails and drinks that really reflect the personality of the restaurant itself. So it seemed like a really good time to sort of stop and say, wait, what's a restaurant and what's a bar? Mm-hmm. You can have food in both, but that food is not the same food. And let's really take a look at the bar because, of course, we're here about drinks. And see, what it is that makes bar food special and separate from just the food you would get in any other establishment.
Yeah, I guess the question is, where are we? I don't know. But it is true. And I feel like there was this moment where you could go to a bar and there are certain things regionally that you could expect to get from a bar. I'm from Southern California, so we didn't really, and it was a place called Laguna Beach. There were a lot of chips, tortilla chips. in other parts of the world, you have the sort of, the cheese puff has always been around. You have peanuts, you have all these things that have been, I think we sort of stereotype bar food as being essentially like stoner snacks. And I think that's true to an extent, and I think that's still true in a lot of dive bars. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about, of course, like two very different genres of bar. And now that the cocktail bar has become something that again is crossing over into the restaurant, we're encountering a lot of really ambitious food that lives in bars. And I guess the question is, you know, how do these bars pay homage? You know, how do these bars pay homage to bar food and still differentiate themselves from restaurants? So I guess to start, we sort of wanted to talk a little bit about our own experiences with bar food. Mm-hmm. And everyone here is from a different place. Reagan is a Canadian, which we always like to have around.
Very exotic.
Very exotic. An exotic Canadian from Vancouver. And Kat is from Kentucky, Leslie's from Ohio, and I'm from California. So I think we're pretty well represented here in different parts of America and Canada to talk a little bit about bar food. So I'm going to toss it over to Kat first and talk a little bit about, you know, for you first, like some early experience with bar food and today, you know, what your sort of your bar food archetype is.
Well, I started my drinking career kind of later than most people would. There were some sort of disreputable taverns where I went to college in Baltimore. They were just places where, you know, which actually they really, really should be. The food was there to keep you from falling off the bar stool, essentially.
It's an important part of bar food.
Right. Yeah. And I think that is its best and highest purpose, really. Mm-hmm. But where I grew up in northern Kentucky, there was always a crock of beer cheese on the bar there. And it's this weird sort of communal tub of cheese that, you know, I don't know if this place is still there or not, but you could drag crackers through it. I think they have something like that at Sardi's as well. But, you know,
can you tell us what beer cheese is?
Oh, it's heaven above. It is a couple kinds of usually cheddar. It has some dark beer mixed into it, some garlic, some mustard, and it's really sharp, beautiful. You want to spread it on some rye and it soaks up your whatever you're drinking pretty solidly.
Yeah.
But I moved to New York in 1996 as, you know, broke post-grad school. Mm-hmm. And bar food was there pretty much to be my dinner, yeah. Essentially, mm-hmm. because I wanted
exactly.
to go, yeah, I wanted to go out and see my friends and, you know, maybe have a drink. And I knew that I probably couldn't afford both a dinner and a drink too. So ideally we would go to spots that had the heftiest bar food, and, you know, the fancier the bar, the, you know, more wasabi peas there would be, mm-hmm. or pretzels or something. And just, I remember this evolution that happened in the late 90s when Dale DeGroff started tending bar at Blackbird. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was this wonderful unicorn of a place where you could suddenly get craft cocktails. And the snacks were a little fancier than I'd seen before. The nuts maybe had a little bit of sweetness to them. There's some, you know, again, the wasabi. And then I remember Mario Batali started having, you know, I think it was hard-boiled eggs on the bar at, I think he probably still does it at Babo. And all of a sudden realizing, wait, it doesn't just have to be pretzels and peanuts and things. It can be these other things. And the way it really came together for me was, you know, as a single woman before I met my husband many years ago, finding that I could sit alone at a bar, have a Manhattan and a plate of oysters, and it was my moment. And I really internalized that I don't have to share these oysters. This drink is mine. And I can just really sit here and be in this moment and have this wonderful aesthetic experience. Mm-hmm. And I just remember feeling like, you know, powerful lady in the big city, even though I was probably like 27 or something. And and not in control of my life whatsoever.
I know what that's like.
I still know what that's like.
It hasn't really changed much. You know, it's interesting too, because we were just in Italy, and mm-hmm. in the bar snack is something that is glorified to a certain extent in Italy, and in America they've never had a moment where the bar snack was sort of much maligned. And in Italy, it's really a matter of food and drink being inseparable, and that you would never think of drinking without eating something.
Yeah.
And in a way, what I love about bar food is it's our way of saying the same thing. It might not be as elegant.
It is.
Right, guys?
Yeah, but they actually, like, some of the older generation there sort of disparage this newer thing that kids do, which they call apericena, which is putting together apericena aperitivo in China, which is dinner. And they, like, it, you know, that's what we do, or what we did, maybe sometimes we still do, at bars when you can't necessarily afford a full meal, but putting these two things together and actually sustaining yourself on food and drink. But there, like, we were all over the place, and the beautiful thing about it is this ritual of sitting down and, like, not necessarily just drinking your face off, but making it a leisurely, everyday sort of thing. Mm-hmm. There are places that put out entire buffets, which isn't, like, the greatest way after a couple of hours to eat aperitivo. But we ate our fair share of snacks there.
Free snacks.
Yeah.
My
the best part, they're all free.
My personal idea of aperitivo was, you know, I went to college in New York here in the city, and I am not proud of this, but I used to go to Alligator Lounge.
Oh, I love Alligator Lounge.
You got free pizza.
Yeah.
And that was my idea of bar food. And it's like everyone was so broke. We would go there. We would have mm-hmm. dinner at Alligator Lounge like several times a week.
Yep.
And I don't, does it still exist?
It still exists. And there's also the Charleston.
There's a Charleston.
Which I may have been to recently.
Yeah.
Pizza's never bad, guys. Even like bad pizza is never bad.
It's true. I know. I really haven't. I'll eat a bagel pizza. I'll eat a frozen pizza. I'll eat any pizza. Like there's no problem with pizza. Ever.
Yeah.
But yeah, and what I really appreciate now is that I've sort of like seen through my own sort of development in drinking, like my evolution, like eating better food happened at the same time. So, and it happened here in New York. And so I watched the bar, I watched drinks change. I watched bars become more sophisticated and by nature of that food. And you had a really interesting point, Reagan, in your debut column for Eating in Bars, and it's about basically how the cocktail bar has changed things. And yeah, I would love for you to talk like a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean the thing, I think, Kat, you nailed it exactly, is as soon as you started having people who were really paying attention to the cocktails mm-hmm. in a place and maybe putting a little bit more attention into the decor and the atmosphere and really the feeling that you got while you were sitting at the bar, it kind of became, well, we can't just give you the same jar of peanuts that we were giving you before, because that doesn't fit in with this aesthetic that became really refined and serious and thoughtful. And so that's the first place you started to see these refined bar snacks.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that I really noticed about every one of your answers was the thing that I love most about bar food is that it allows you to stay out and stay with your friends longer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whether it's something terrible and sad and it just keeps you from falling off your stool.
Yes.
Or if it's the aperitivo tradition, it's about keeping people together longer when you're drinking. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something to soak it up just so you can stay out that extra hour. If you're broke, you can stay out with your friends a little bit more because you've got that free pizza to keep you going.
Oh, speaking
free
of pizza. Pizza just arrived in front of us.
I can conjure pizza with my words.
That's why we hired you.
Yeah, I wonder.
Telepathy.
You know, if this is like where did the bar snack, I don't know if it's the reinvention of or the presence of the bar snack, is that a New York thing? Did that come about? Like, where can we pinpoint a place?
I mean, New York has always had this grand tradition of bar food. If you think about it, like I think Old Town Tavern mm-hmm. has always been a place where you eat and you drink and you can do it fairly economically. I'm thinking, you know, the at McSorley's, that grand tradition of, you know, the big slice of onion and the cheese.
There,
too. Yeah.
So, crackers.
Yeah. I mean, so I think it's always had that kind of tradition to it. But really, I don't know. Increasingly more money than I had when I was, you know, a broke grad student to start to go to better places. But it really was like Dale DeGroff and Audrey Saunders going to Bemelman's bar.
Even when Pegu opened, had a great and still does have a great little list of bar snacks. And, mm-hmm. you know, ironically, you know, one of the fancier cocktail bars that opened and served pretty hefty food was PDT by mm-hmm. nature of being next to Griff Dogs, and you'd be drinking, still can drink really beautiful cocktails right alongside a hot dog and some waffle fries and liquid cheese.
Yeah. Yeah. Employees only had that very fancy menu.
Oh, God. The late night moussaka.
Mm-hmm.
That was still a good feature.
Yeah.
Still there.
It's still there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap that up and we'll take a short break. And we'll be back to talk more about eating in bars and drinking in restaurants.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Punch Radio. We're here talking about eating in bars and drinking in restaurants. We're here with Kat Kinsman, the editor-in-chief of Tasting Table, Reagan Hoffman, contributing editor at Punch. I'm Talia Bayoki, the editor-in-chief, and Leslie right next to me is the deputy editor. And we were just talking about eating in bars and all of the important nostalgic things that that means to us. And what we're going to segue into now is what is the future and what are the places that we really love that are doing things that are different, that are kind of pushing boundaries and are asking and are prompting that question, what does it mean to eat in bars? So I guess I'll start with, for me, I mean, I've come a little bit of come a small way from Alligator Lounge, not far. But I like to pretend that I have at the Nomad Bar, yes. Because that is some real classy food and some really classy drinks. And I like what they've done with the new place where you're kind of standing around, like you are at a bar. There is no mistaking that you're sitting anywhere. You're most of the time you're not sitting. There's no mistaking where you are, and you can have this incredible fried chicken. You can have an incredible flatbread. You can have all of this food that actually it is really when you break it down, it is food that you want to eat when you're drinking. It's just better.
It's got all the things that you want. I mean, I think what I require of a bar snack is something that has carbs. is preferably, I mean, it doesn't always have to be warm, but it's always nice when you get something that's like, you know, gooey with cheese on it. Or, you know, like maybe, I don't know if we all eat meat here, but, you know, has like a burger is always a good bet when you're at a bar. A pile of fries. Like if it comes with a pile of fries, nobody is going to say no. Like you don't get the salad, you get the fries. Yeah, I mean, I that hot dog at the Nomad is really like a once every 6 months sort of thing. But oh man, it's so good. The other place that I really love to eat bar food is Prime Meats, and I guess you know it sort of stretches the boundaries of what bar food means. But you can get everything from oysters to steak frites, and you can sit at that beautiful old timey bar, and it feels like you're at a bar. Where are you going, Kat, lately?
Well, I sort of embraced the high-low of all of this, and especially in my travels. So on the low but awesome end, I love the Double Down in Las Vegas, where it's a 24-hour bar. If you've never been there, you owe it to yourself to spend some time there.
We need to go there.
Oh, my gosh. They have...
Let's go on a field trip after this.
It's so good. They have what they call ass juice, and you want to get some shots of that. They have a Fat Elvis cocktail that is a beautiful like peanut butter and banana thing. The only snacks they have there are Slim Jims and Twinkies, and you can buy like an ass juice and a Twinkie, or if they just like, they'll just toss one to you. I think I actually have a Slim Jim from the Double Down in my purse as we speak. And they use them as the swizzle in their Bloody Mary, and they're really fantastic.
That's incredible.
It's such a fantastic place, open 24 hours a day, and they bill themselves as the happiest place on earth, which they truly are.
I really respect the place that does the packaged bar food. They're we're not even going to try. We're just going to sell you, like, it's like the pub model, the crisps in the back, just the Slim Jims, deal with it. You got to eat something, here you go.
It's so perfect. And then on the higher end, there are two bars that I think are kind of sister establishments to each other. I think both Sun Bar and then Husk in Charleston because they both embrace the ham plate.
The ham plate is great.
It's such a great thing. And I think they both use Benton's ham. And, you know, there
and
it
Sam
is.
And Sam does that red eye gravy with the coffee, like mayo. Oof, that's good stuff.
It's such a beautiful thing. And then at Husk, they do a cheeseburger there that is just this legendary, beautiful thing. And there's a separate bar at Husk there, too. And it feels like a whole different land. And you can have some of the best cocktails in the U.S. and have that burger. And you can have some pickled okra. You can have some pimento cheese or something. So I think there's this sort of ham, like ham highway between the two of them. But both of them
have drive all night long on a ham highway.
So I just feel like they're really embracing like excellent ingredients and craft to go along with these fantastic cocktails that are just paired beautifully with them.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I really, the high-low for sure, and I think the most important thing about bar food is it has to be, you have to be able to eat it with one hand.
This is
my personal rule. And you kind of, you got to it, Talia, talking about the Nomad, where you're standing around, you know, you don't necessarily have a lot of real estate. You maybe have to hold on to your drink at all times because there's people around you or you don't have a lot of space. So you have to be able to pick up whatever you're going to eat while holding your drink, which is, I mean, it's just good advice for life anyway, but it's especially important in a crowded bar. So one-handed is very important. Carbs, I think, definitely also a crucial factor. one of my all-time favorite bar snacks, and this is, you know, it's a place that has three things on the menu, but at Amore Amargo, they do a scotched pickled egg, which is...
The Scotch egg is having a little bit of a renaissance right
Scotch
now.
Scotch egg is having a renaissance. Pickles are having a renaissance. And this is just this perfect confluence of the two. And it's the most satisfying thing you want. And it's got the fry on it. It's got the sour from the brine. It's just my favorite thing.
They do the spice chickpea thing there as well, which is really nice.
I forget that I always forget that Amore Amargo actually has food.
Because it's only there if you really need it. If you're there, you're drinking and you're paying attention to the cocktails, which are fabulous. But then if you get hungry, you have your option and you can take it and just kind of roll along.
And I think messaging the fact that like you can eat at a bar is difficult because I saw, you know, in my neighborhood in Park Slope, I was so sad to see Terroir not work because people would go in there for a drink and not really embrace it as a place where you could go and eat, and the food was phenomenal.
The food is always very good there.
I think that was one of the big missed opportunities. You know, they had that pork blade steak, they had so many incredible things on that menu, and I think it was so small, it was like the perfect place for bar food, and he and Marco made an incredible menu for that place, and unfortunately, now we can have Brodo. I mean, fortunately. Excuse me. Brodo, guys.
To shift this to the higher end, I really love when you go to... I think that 11 Madison does this. I know Bemelman's does it. The little silver, like, triangular... what do you call that thing? But it comes
the
and
sections?
It's got the section, like
sections.
A sectioned off snack plate, and you get like your little Chex
Mix. It's like
mix.
A TV dinner, but like with snacks.
With snacks, yeah. Like at 11 Madison, they do like, you know, their house made potato chips, olives, and then those like delicious spice nuts that you can. They may as well just fill the whole tray with those. And at Bemelman's, what do they do there?
Bemelman's is potato chips and I think a nut mix as well.
Like, if anything comes with three parts to it and they're refilling it for free, I'm in.
There might be, in like, the Asian mix, I think, at Bevelman's.
Oh,
maybe. There's maybe
the
a little
wasabi.
Yeah, with those weird orange rice crackers.
Somehow, like, you see the bartender, like, refilling these things from, like, the mass buckets behind the bar, and still it's, like, very classy when it comes to your table.
This
is no problem with communal food, ever.
No.
Actually.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, there's some people who just can't embrace that. I'm like, you're really missing out on the
whole
point of this.
Don't worry about it. You're on a subway. Like, I mean, just like, it's fine. We're all friends.
Yeah. You live in New York City, you're touching other people's hands, whether you want to or not. Every day.
You know, I was at the bar at the Four Seasons recently, the Thai bar that's in the hotel, and, you know, paying $20-some for my French 75 there. And I made sure I got the most of those bar snacks.
Exactly. I'm making a meal out of this.
And they were pretty good. And it was still that mix of, like, you know, the nuts, the little pretzel bits, the you know, the wasabi and stuff, but made sure they refilled that at least once.
And so, everyone has, like, for me, I had a long conversation about Chex Mix the other day, which is a really, you know, what is the one thing you pick out of the, is it the Melba toast?
Melba toast.
The Melba toast is, like, I know, but everyone wants the Melba toast.
Don't be that guy at the bar. That's all I got to say.
I'm that guy at
don't
the bar.
Don't eat all the Melba toast.
I'm that guy.
It's the MSG.
So what we're all saying is that we're in a good, pretty good place with the state of the bar snack in the United States. Like, yeah. Would we call this peak bar snack? Is that too much? Is it crazy?
I don't know if we're
can there ever really be a peak?
We have so many places we can go.
There's so much more we can do. I mean, if you look at pretty much every other culture in the world, there's so, like, centuries advanced in on us. Yeah. About the bar snack. You know, they've got, there's
Pompeii had bar snacks.
Exactly. You know, Japanese drinking culture with food goes back hundreds of years, and, you know, Spain and everywhere. And
yeah.
We're just scratching the surface.
It's actually true. One of the things that when we introduced City Guides in October, we were covering all of these cities around the world. And what's amazing is that most other cities outside of the United States have sort of a walking bar culture, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word. And in Tokyo, we have a whole list for, I think it's pronounced, it's either Takinomi or Tachinomi. And it's standing bars. And they're, you know, each place is known for one snack. And you always have at least one drink while you're there, while you're eating something with one hand, most likely. And then you move on. And it's not dissimilar in Spain. You know, mm-hmm. you can find these streets where you just
movable feast.
Exactly.
Literally. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, New Orleans, though, some people disparage the idea of walking and drinking there because it has a different connotation when you're talking about tourists on Bourbon Street. But it really does embrace that old world tradition of taking your drink with you. Like, you're constantly moving. There's no delay in going to see a friend at another bar if you have a drink. You just... Yeah. Pour it into a plastic cup and go.
Yeah.
Oh, the go cup is the sign of a civilized society.
New Orleans is way ahead of us.
It really, yes. truly
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
Well, let's wrap that up there, and then we're going to come back to you, and we're going to talk a little bit more about drinking in restaurants. I'm Leslie Pariseau. I'm here with Talia Baiocchi. This is Punch Radio, and we will be back soon. Welcome back to Punch Radio. I am your host, Leslie Pariseau from Punch Magazine, and I'm here with my co-host, Talia Baiocchi, editor-in-chief. And today we're talking about eating in bars and drinking in restaurants. It's sort of an introduction to our newest column called Eating in Bars, which contributing editor Regan Hoffman, who is here with us, is heading up. And we wanted to take this last segment to talk about drinking in restaurants. And this sort of all goes back to a moment earlier in the winter when New York Times columnist Pete Wells came out with a pretty controversial article in the food and drink world declaring that drinks in restaurants just aren't that great. And a lot of people took issue with it because a lot of people have been working really hard to make drinking in restaurants better. And so we just wanted to sort of pick apart these issues today and talk about what is the state of drinking in restaurants, because across the board, it's changed a lot in the past few years. We were talking about the confluence of, you know, what does it mean to drink in a bar versus drinking in a restaurant? So I'm here with Kat Kinsman, who is the editor of Tasting Table, and she knows Pete well, and she's sat in bars with him and in restaurants with him and eaten and drank with him. And I would love to hear what you think specifically on this issue.
Well, I can't, there's a definite parallel between when I started to drink better and when I met Pete Wells in the late 90s. I mean, it happened, I met him through an ex-boyfriend who, you know, he and I were sort of exploring cocktails together, and he and Pete had been friends for a long time. So, I just sort of put that all together. But Pete is an incredible maker of drinks himself. And I think maybe that's something people don't know so much about him, is that he really reveres the craft of drinks. He makes a better punch than just about anybody in the whole world. And I have to say, I agree with him a lot on this, because I'm a person who, I probably am a great frustration to sommeliers everywhere, because mm-hmm. I drink cocktails during my meal generally. And I think there's a tide turning back to drinks getting a little bit more straightforward. But for a while, it seemed like everybody was just throwing everything in their spice cabinet and everything in their fridge toward the bar, and it was a muddle. It was a mess. These things weren't balancing so well. They were fighting with the food for attention when they really could have been just honing down a smaller list of drinks. I agreed with that article in that he was saying these things are too long, and you know, they get sort of flowery notes about what this drink is, and you know, an homage to this thing in the past, but never closely enough. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some restaurants around New York who have really started to nail their game. They've scaled back their menu, and maybe just having a few different ingredients all made incredibly well in there. You know, I'm thinking like Batard specifically, where I was talking during the break. I'm going there tonight, and they have a really carefully chosen cocktail menu that Candace, the bartender, has put together there, and it's mostly classics, just really focusing in on, you know, good rum and good fruit juices and things, and just balanced beautifully to go with the food. But it was definitely designed with that menu in mind, whereas I think maybe there was a disconnect between the kitchen and the bartenders in a lot of restaurants for a while. And maybe this, you know, within this culture of mixologists and people becoming superstars, there was a fight for status going on.
That's,
I don't know,
true.
And I just felt like it was some subpar drinks happening for a while.
I wonder, I'm interested, if you are a drinker of cocktails throughout your meal, what do you actually prefer to drink when you're eating?
Oh, I have a whole thing about French 75s that I love them.
Gin or cognac?
You know, whatever the bartender wants to do. And I love asking for French 75s at places where it's not on the menu, because mm-hmm. they come up with their own version of it. I've had them in pint glasses over ice. I've had them in flutes.
Hey.
I've had one bartender who switches it up every single time I come in to try to surprise me. Now I show up at bars. It was at in Charleston at the Food and Wine Festival, and at an event, and the GM walked over to me and said, I wonder if you'd like a French 75, because I Instagram
Ooh,
them all the time.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I use a hashtag French 75 gram. So
you're the French 75 girl.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing to be.
It's such a simple cocktail mm-hmm. too. But it enhances just about anything you're going to eat, because there's champagne or Prosecco in it, and there's a little bit of sweetness. There's lemon, and there you go.
It's nice. I like that. French 75 gram, everybody.
Yeah.
To go back to the article though, Regan, can you talk a little bit about like the larger point that I think some people took issue with in regards to how this relates to food?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I have to, first of all, I have to respectfully disagree.
That's all right.
That's why we're here, guys.
The thing that I find really inspiring about where restaurant cocktails are now and where they're still headed, because I agree they're not there yet. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely a lot of places that just kind of feel like, we should have a bar program, and what do we do, and somebody figure out how to make some drinks.
Yeah.
And that, of course, you end up with a mess, and you have people who sort of look at what are the trends in cocktail bars, we should figure out how to do something like that. And that's where you end up with these drinks that are exactly as Pete Wells described, just not balanced and fighting with everything and just not good drinks. If you were in a cocktail bar, they would still not be good drinks.
Right.
But I think for me, the really inspiring thing is that these restaurants are trying and they're looking at cocktails as seriously as they're thinking about their food.
Yeah.
And they're looking at cocktails as an extension of what the restaurant brings.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, you know, we don't have to just have the classics. That's not actually potentially what we're about. You know, if you're at a regional Italian restaurant or if you're at a fucking Cajun restaurant or
yeah.
if you're at...
It's okay. This is Heritage Radio.
I've been really good so far. You know, you can be at a restaurant that purports to serve food from a number of different traditions, but they're all supposed to serve you the same Manhattan and the same martini. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I will always give it a try. I will say that, like, if I see that there are deliberately cocktails on the menu, I will always, always give it a try. And these days, more often than not, I'm really pleasantly surprised. It's just there was a phase there for a while when it was a little dicey.
Yeah. And of course, P. Wells, he eats for a living. He sees so much more of the bad stuff than we do.
Of course. Like, so. I mean, if you come to New York not knowing where to eat, or any city for that matter, 90% of your experience could be terrible because you're just wandering in off the street to someplace that looks like it could be cozy or cute.
Yeah.
I think what, you know, overall we're seeing is that it's a little bit of growing pains. We have come to a point where we are, every city that you go to has at least a number of cocktail bars you can count on one hand, whether that's Kansas City or Chicago or New York or San Francisco. But everybody's trying to up their game across the board, and that's like that's really hopeful. In the meantime, you're going to drink a lot of bad stuff while people figure it out, and that's not like I think we'll get there.
There's an interesting thing about New York as well, and I think the New York is like a little bit sort of in a way a little behind the game with this, because San Francisco, the interesting thing is that so much of what happened in San Francisco, so much of the cocktail renaissance in San Francisco happened in restaurants.
Yeah.
In New York, that has not really been a part of our culture. It happened in cocktail bars. And so I think what the interesting question might be is, like, what do we really want from restaurant cocktail programs?
Yeah.
Like, do we want to say, you know, stick with drinks that are truly compatible with the food that you're creating? Or would we allow that this bar stand alone, in a sense? You know, I'm sort of somewhere in between where I'm torn because, yes, there's, like, a lot of really bad restaurant cocktails out there. There's a lot of, like, overwrought stuff. And I think it's just everyone's kind of, like, kid in a candy store. Like, they show up and they're like, I want to create the most, like, you know, whatever, the most original drink. And you know, my question is, at one point we're going to create modern classics. And do they need to happen? Do they need to be created in cocktail bars? Or can they also be created in restaurants? There's something to be said about using the assets of a restaurant to create great cocktails. And I think that's what I hope for the future, is that bartenders start using the chef, the pastry department of a restaurant to really start innovating in that way. I think we'll end up with very different cocktails.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing more of that too. I mean, Tali and I have been testing recipes for a book that we're working on right now. And a lot of the recipes that have come into me use some sort of footnote suggestion for, you know, it's written for a bartender or a bar, but the footnote suggestion is that when you're done using, like, the hulls of the strawberries or the peels of the lemons, mm-hmm. it go to the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And it's because they're taking this from their playbook that they're sending to their bartenders who are making these drinks. Mm-hmm. So it's a thing that I think we're seeing more. We're also seeing sort of these alliances between the kitchen or the pastry chef mm-hmm. and the cocktail bar, and taking hints from one another. There's a restaurant in Houston that's doing this. The name escapes me now, but it's an example we've used in a recent piece. And they're specifically making sure that whatever the pastry chef is doing is in line with the desserts they're serving mm-hmm. At the end of the meal. I think that we should shift really quickly, just so we have some time to talk about this mm-hmm. Before we leave. What does wine service mean in all of this?
Yeah, wine service is a tough one, but because I think that's been a category where people feel like innovation does not apply in this realm. Mm-hmm. And I think we can talk about two different things. One being, when you walk into a restaurant and you don't, you know, the wine has become, over the past decade and a half,
our market, especially in New York, San Francisco, LA, incredibly diverse. Like we have wines that are available now that were not available 10 years ago. So you can feasibly walk into a restaurant and absolutely not recognize anything on a wine list. And I think that's been a big topic of discussion. And then, you know, of course, talking about how, I think more importantly, how to present wine and in a way that feels in line with the ethos of a restaurant and little things that you can do in that department. And I think we're seeing that at EMP with port tonguing, something so simple where it is this, there is pomp and circumstance, but I think it creates a sense of theater that food can often create in a restaurant mm-hmm. on the wine side. And that was something that I think no one was thinking about a long time ago. And it's happening with drinks as well in the cocktail front. EMP doing a tableside Manhattan service.
And I think
all of these things.
We have to remember, too, that theater has always, always been part of the bar and restaurant. This is not a new thing. Like the Blue mm-hmm. Blazer, pre-Prohibition, and it still stands today as one of the most theatrical rituals in drink making. And port tonguing, even. Port tonguing is not a new, it's not a new ritual. Sabering champagne. This is something that we've all seen, mm-hmm. and even if it has been, we've hit peak.
Sabering.
We still are so delighted whenever you see somebody take out a very sharp object to chop off a bottleneck.
As Patrick said, people like explosions, even in restaurants. Yeah.
It's true, and we have to remember we are not coming up with this stuff. This is something that it. Anything that adds drama to the experience of eating and drinking, people want.
And I think that's maybe part of where the cocktail went wrong a little, is trying to create a little bit too much drama. But I think you know, I would love to hear from you guys where you the places that you've been to that have really, back to UCAT, that you've been to that you really feel like are doing an incredible job with their cocktail specifically.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, just for wine for a second, I love being knocked off guard. And that's why I've always loved like what Paul Greco does, because he has that confrontational wine list, because you may or may not love it, but you'll remember it. Mm-hmm. And he's so thoughtful. My MO with this tends to be, you know, really just have a conversation with the sommelier. I'm okay not knowing things. I will inevitably like embrace a pairing. Some of my very favorite wines that I've ever had have been wines that were served specifically with a course. The best things happen when the chef and the sommelier and the bartender are all talking with each other, because they really want to create this wonderful unified vision. Mm-hmm. And I've been to, say, some wine dinners mm-hmm. where the entire experience was elevated just because of that great conversation that was all happening together. And mm-hmm. you just walk out of there feeling the totality of it. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I think the best sort of synthesis of that I'd ever had was Alinea, which is was the most wonderful theatrical thing in so many different ways. And you know, just the experience of how the wine happened was surprise and shock and mm-hmm. awe. Mm-hmm. And I went in there feeling like I'm not responsible for having to make any decisions. I'm just going to let this happen to me. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm most comfortable at that point. And then afterwards, I'll go back and say, what was that wine? Can you write mm-hmm. it down? How do I find more of this? And, you know, and really like letting the experts drive the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I've inevitably been so much happier when that happens.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I feel exactly the same way. Yeah. What about you?
I think, you know, I was thinking about this. The theater aspect is really interesting. There's also a way you can think about theater as sort of just creating a world, right? Mm-hmm. Which so many restaurants try to do. Yeah. And one of my favorite restaurants with amazing cocktails was the Butterfly, Michael Weiss mm-hmm. restaurant down in Tribeca, which was just a little place, but it was the whole world was created so perfectly for you, and the cocktails were an integral part of it, still are. Eben Freeman created the list for him, and it's the whole place is this mid-century Wisconsin supper club vibe. Mm-hmm. And you walk in, and it's this gorgeous, like, I would just kill to have it in my house, mm-hmm. back bar with this mirrored teak, just the most perfect mid-century architecture. Mm-hmm. And then you sit down, and you're eating fried cheese curds, and the cocktails are, you know, he's got a grasshopper. But it's like the most perfectly done, really thoughtful, actually made with real things, not that weird neon creme de menthe. It was the perfect creation of a world. And for me, that's a kind of theater. Yeah. And that's a thing that you can do really well when you bring the cocktails in with the rest of the restaurant.
Yeah. This is really old school, but, and I don't know if this is, it must be a tradition. in Brooklyn, there's a restaurant called Bomonti's, which I know Talia loves too. And it's not a place that you're going to go for a cocktail, though. If you ask for something, they're going to make it. Like, it's an old guy behind the bar. He's like 80 something, and he's
the Negroni
like,
comes in like a tiny goblet.
Yeah. there's a blender back there. I don't know what they
there's
use it for.
There's some stuff going on.
But this is one of those places where when you go to eat at the restaurant, I think almost everybody stands up front and has a drink first. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's this ritual of, like, it's the aperitif, but, I mean, they're not going to call it that there. It's not nearly fancy enough. It's this ritual, though, of standing around with each other, getting ready to have a meal, and just being together. And that's, like, that could be, like, a Miller High Life Pony from that weird fridge up front, or yeah. It could be a Negroni and a goblet.
But not. Don't serve yourself from the fridge, okay? Just don't.
And, like, a conversation with this, like, old guy and, like, Gino standing next to him, you know?
Yeah.
But this is one of my favorite places to go drinking before I eat in mm-hmm. Brooklyn, and it's because of that. And that there is a certain theater to it. This man's in a tuxedo. All of the waiters are in tuxedos. There's the hostess up front who's yelling your last name and pronouncing it with an Italian accent, even though she's from Brooklyn. It's a really special place. If you have not been there and you live in Brooklyn, you should make it a stop. It's a century old. It is perfect.
For me, starting when I started eating in restaurants really seriously, there was something exceedingly grown up and special and very cool about having a drink at the bar before you got
exactly.
seated.
Exactly. People don't do that as much anymore.
Nobody. I always make a point. If I can, I make a point to get there. Like, if I'm meeting people, I get mm-hmm. there 5 minutes early just so that I can sit at the bar for a minute by myself and have that drink.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when everyone else joins in, you go and you sit down. And usually when I'm eating, I have wine if that's where I am at. But I'm always
that's where I'm at.
but starting with that cocktail at the bar is just a nice part of the ritual that really makes it feel like a special event.
Yeah. Well, that's all the time we have, you guys. Kat Kinsman from Tasting Table, thank you so much for being here. Regan, our contributing editor, thank you. Read her column, Eating in Bars. My co-host, Talia Baiocchi, and I am Leslie Parisot, and this is Punch Radio. Visit us at punchdrink.com. We've got all the good stuff there.
Happy weekend.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.